Blog Talk Radio.
We're a nation of haters under their control. Rise up everybody and burn down, burn down. The system fails, the exit moves. Wake up the silence with the hands. I'm feeling the love in the silence club. I can feel the space between us. Little Captain and the common man. Time to show them all.
Welcome to the Star Chamber, episode number 15, and it's a nice number. It sounds like we're actually getting somewhere now, which is cool. And, of course, the bumpin' music by Zero King, who are going to be appearing at Imaginarium in September, which we announced last week. That's awesome. And, oh, man, it's just been just such a busy, busy week. And we got a wonderful guest tonight, a guy that I've been hearing about for a long time. Big favorite of Alex's, and a guy that definitely is a good writer, but I've been really looking forward to meeting him. So we're going to be getting to him in just a second and with a full introduction. And before then, I thought, we'd cover a little bit of news because, of course, we're sponsored by Seven Star Press, Imaginarium, and Tomorrow Comes Media. So wow, this week we are doing 5 cover reveals, and the third was done today, and that was Jason Sizemore's Irredeemable, which is a single author collection from Jason, and it's got a special intro by Jeffrey Gerard and a blurb by Maurice Brodus on the cover. Just a great release. And then yesterday we also had a cover reveal, which was H. David Blaylock's Doom Angel, which was the third book in the Angel Killer Triad, just a phenomenal urban fantasy, apocalyptic with a little dystopian edge kind of series, which I think is actually one of the best written series out there, major press, small press, or anything. So, I mean, this is just a tight, really superbly written trilogy. And then I left the Monday for last because I know that there's one of our co-hosts is definitely eager to chatter about this, so I'm going to definitely give him the opportunity here. But Monday, we unveiled the cover for Southern Haunts 2, Devils in the Darkness, and announced the ebook release. The ebook will be available tomorrow, as a matter of fact. And print will be out next week, that kind of segues into our guest tonight. So we're going to talk a little bit about a couple convention things, but let's give Alex a chance to talk about Southern Haunts 2. Here you go, man.
Oh my God, it was amazing getting this anthology together, such as Volume 1. I just had the opportunity to work with great people and had the opportunity to really dive into some history and folklore for the area. And as a matter of fact, with some of the stories that I received regarding the South and Southwest, I was able to learn folklore that I had never heard about before, to the point where I could actually do research and find out more about these areas. And the fun thing about Southern Haunts is, of course, with this series, of course, we do take an area that is an actual area and an event that is an actual event, and we fictionalize it to the point of what would happen if our characters went there. And just to see some of the hell that everyone rose over this, it's amazing. So for those who are fans of Volume 1, you are definitely in for a treat on Volume 2, and the guidelines are already up for Part 3.
So I know you, I mean, just in talking to you, Alex, you've been really pumped about this one. I mean, do you think it's a good growth from the first one, Spirits That Walk Among Us, as far as the,
oh, God, yeah.
Different types of stories?
It is. Spirits That Walk Among Us is always going to have a place in my heart because that is my first baby I ever produced with J.L. Mulvihill, and she is a fantastic author and a co-editor to work with, and so I was very blessed with that. Unfortunately, since J.L. Mulvihill wasn't able to join this series as an editor, we were able to get a poem from her in Volume 2. And I was able to work with Louise Myers, which she had been a better reader for me for quite some time, and also a smaller editor out of the editors I normally work with. And when I presented the idea to her, she was just ecstatic. And like J.L. Mulvihill, she was very gracious in what we chose. We had really deep discussions on who made it and who didn't. And a lot of the people that we had to turn away, it wasn't because their stories were bad. It's just that we can only put so much in one book.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And watch out, Alex, because I may give you a haiku, one of my famous haikus for the third book. You never know.
Okay.
Don't worry. You're like, no. Don't worry. I won't torture you that bad. But tomorrow, in fact, we, like I said, we got 5 cover reveals, and tomorrow we are going to be unveiling Aaron Drown's Mage of None Magic, great fantasy book, and it's got interior illustrations from Jason Conley, so we're going to be showing those off tomorrow, and Friday is actually really cool, too. We got Awesome Jones, new release from Ashley Rose Sullivan, which actually is a superhero fairy tale. It's really a different book, and even the look of it and the formatting of it's different than a traditional novel, so, I mean, it's really a cool book. But looming on the horizon, I want to bring our other two co-hosts into this because I got to see the near final of Michael's new one, and I've seen the final of Sayla's. So talk about your awesome new cover arts because those are going to be shown to the public probably in a week or two.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about the cover for Hayes Disciples. It's got a real retro 70s kind of feel to it. I think Matt just knocked it out of the park on that one.
You've been working with Jason.
Oh yeah, I'm really stoked. I think I'm really stoked about Old School's cover. I think it's a very different kind of a fantasy book, and I think the cover really kind of encapsulates that. And I think people are just going to be really pleased all the way around. I think it's really going to do some fun stuff. But, yeah, it's gorgeous. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous cover.
Yes, I guess we'll be in a celebratory mood this Saturday. Unfortunately, I wish Alex could pop up and join us, but Sayla, Michael, and I will be converging on the fine town of Madison. I wish they had their bridge fixed in that one area. But so people coming from Kentucky, be aware. They take an alternate route. But the author's fair, in 4th Annual Author's Fair at that book place, that's going to be fun this Saturday.
Yeah. Be awesome.
I wish I could make it up there. Sometimes I wish I had a twin or maybe a triplet or something of myself and, you know, just send the lesser liked one of the two or three to do all my daytime work and then I'd go do all the fun stuff.
Yeah, if Michael gets ambushed by somebody in a fish costume, then we'll know that Sayla has arrived.
Yeah, I haven't done it yet. That's like my goal within the next like year and a half is I want to make a fish person costume and just like stalk Michael around the convention.
That would be awesome.
Now, is there a specific fish you're going for, like a koi or a goldfish or a catfish?
It would be something from his book, or giant catfish really freaked me out anyway, so maybe I'd go my own route and make like a killer giant catfish and just see what he has to say about that. I don't know. It would be whatever I could actually build.
Just don't nerve me too. While it's happening.
When I lived in Texas, I mean, we actually lived near some of those dams where they had the legends of the gigantic catfish that they would see. They actually did have some bigger catfish on campus because they had baby ducks that were disappearing, and finally somebody was witness to it. But yeah,
The ones in India where like they eat the water buffalo. Like I'm sorry, nothing like you get at Cracker Barrel should be able to eat you. Like I just can't deal with it.
Right.
It's, ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Oh man. But on that. On that note, since we got a good horror tone going here, now's the time to bring in our awesome guest tonight. But I'm going to turn it over to Alex to do the grand Alexander S. Brown introduction for tonight's guest, and then we'll get him on board.
Yay. All right. Well, hello, Miguel. Welcome to our show.
Hello. Good evening.
And how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty well.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I've had the pleasure of working with you twice, once in Spirits That Walk Among Us, Southern Haunts Volume 1, and also in the sequel, Devils in the Darkness. And the mm-hmm. horror that you produce is very thought-provoking, and it's old school, which I really love old school. So if anyone's out there listening, that's a good way you can get top-notch in the anthology is just go old school. Now, what made you a fan of the horror genre?
You know, I think it was cinema and film, really. I remember being really young and watching a lot of horror movies, but I think the first one that I ever really took to was The Exorcist, which I'm sure you've all seen.
That was
a really frightening movie, and I think even today, very few can really compare to that striking feeling that it gives you. A lot of it really did just come from my adolescence and just being young, the different shows that I watched on TV. I used to really like Tales from the Crypt a lot. I even watched Are You Afraid of the Dark on Nickelodeon. I thought that was a really, really scary show for that age group.
I actually got the DVDs of Are You Afraid of the Dark. I recently got that, and I'm watching it now like, wow, that actually scared me, but still cool.
Yeah, I'm sure that's really enjoyable to relive all those. There's still this movie out that called Silver Bullet that was a pretty old werewolf movie.
Yeah.
Scared me so bad when I was younger. I just could not watch that film. And even today I still won't watch that because I was just traumatized by that werewolf or something. It's just a very frightening movie. So I've always really taken to those different horror narratives in those films. I like them a lot.
Yeah, Silver Bullet's a true classic, and as far as the werewolf genre is concerned, I really hope that it makes the comeback, breaks away from all of this little, you know, romanticism, because that's not what werewolves are. They're meant to scare the hell out of you.
And
now,
they did for me.
Speaking of which...
That's one reason I like Dog Soldiers.
Monster. Yeah,
oh,
Dog,
that was good.
Oh, yeah,
wow.
That was awesome.
Dog Soldiers is one of my favorites too. For me, I don't know what it is, but you know, the Werewolf Women of the SS trailer that was in Grindhouse. the fact that a werewolf is scary enough, but give a werewolf an automatic weapon, and for some reason that just freaks me out.
You know, I still want Rob Zombie to do that movie. Just saying. Now, with your love of horror, Miguel, it actually goes a few steps deeper because when you were in college, you took classes regarding the horror genre, and how did those broaden your horizons? Because I know that you had mentioned numerous times, especially in your bio, that you had studied under certain names, and could you elaborate on that for us?
Definitely. And when I was at college, I took two gender and horror classes. The first one was as part of my bachelor's degree, and the second, advanced gender and horror, was for my master's. And those were women's studies courses, and they were really in-depth analyses of femininity and masculinity in the horror genre. They were gender studies based on, like, patriarchal border crossings and things like that. The classes were really exciting because I didn't expect to really have an opportunity to take something like that at the college level. You know, I was just a horror fan going to college, and then this opportunity happened to show up, so I jumped at it, of course. But I actually learned a lot in terms of the genre and just how deep it really does go. I think a lot of people look at the genre itself for face value, and they see just the blood and the gore and things like that, but I think there have been a lot of periods in horror films specifically that really exemplify a lot of different themes and things like that. And I know in the late 80s, you know, we saw the rise of the slasher flick and things like that. And they're completely gendered. Three of the sociologists that I really took to, one was Barbara Creed, Carol J. Clover, and Julia Kristeva. And they each contributed in some way to analyses of these gendered themes in horror. Julia Kristeva, she sort of started it out, I would say so. She turned out to be a a very integral part of the analysis of horror in higher education. She was a Bulgarian-French philosopher and a sociologist, and she studied abjection, you know, the things that are bad and unpleasant and degrading, the things that really make us cringe to a certain extent. The things that are, you know, in border crossing, the unacceptable and the acceptable. She talked a lot about, you know, the corpse and the human, the body and things like that, and just what it is about those specific symbols that really strike fear in people. And she found that a lot of it wasn't necessarily the tangible things like the blood, but it sort of was identity and the system and order and how that disruption of all of those things really was horrific for the genre. Now, Barbara Creed, she was probably one of my favorites, and she coined this idea of the monstrous feminine in the 80s. You know, we saw movies like Carrie, where we had Margaret White, this frightening mother figure, and of course, the character Carrie, the story was entirely about her femininity and her coming-of-age story and just how difficult that was when faced with these conflicting images, one from her mother and external images as well. So I think she was probably one of my favorites. I always liked the gendered horror genre, the subgenre. It's one of my faves. Carol Clover, she did a lot about the slasher films.
She wrote Men, Women, and Chainsaws, didn't she?
Yes,
or
exactly.
Or is that a different Carol
exactly
Clover?
Right. No, yeah. That's yeah. Exactly. Yes, she was fascinating. And I really loved reading portions of that book. It was great. I liked a lot of her work in terms of her uncovering, you know, in the slasher film, these ideas of how sexuality was sort of a monstrous tool and, you know, the final girl who bypassed all of those things and ends up here at the end of the film. It was a great read, and I learned a lot from these different theorists, and I just didn't know how deep that went until reading more into them.
Wow, that is really deep, and I'm glad your college offered that. I mean, I wish more would. It would probably bring a greater understanding to the horror genre versus people saying, well, this movie was the cause for this school shooting or so on and so forth. It would bring a lot more understanding to the adrenaline rush that comes with it.
Yeah, I think they're deep.
I was just going to say, when I was in college, I had an actual Stephen King course. It was taught by the professor taught two courses. He taught a course in Shakespeare and a course in Stephen King. And, you know, it was really fascinating to approach, you know, the Stephen King works from a classical perspective and, you know, all the different tropes and whatnot and to really dissect it. And I love that class. I actually took it twice because you could take it twice for credit. And he did a different series of books in each one of the courses. So I enjoyed it the first time around so much. I took it again to get his insight into the other set of books.
That's exactly what I did. We had the same round of movies the first class, took it the second time, same movies, but you just got in deeper in the analysis. And a lot of our curriculum was constructed around really looking at these movies, these examples, and then factoring in how they worked in with our articles and things like that on the gendered relations in the actual film. It was really fascinating because a lot of those movies I'd never really thought about from that perspective. So I found myself sitting, you know, with my friends. I remember being with my friend Erica, you know, sitting watching horror movies and taking notes and notes and pages of notes, just watching this film and just getting so excited just about being able to uncover and just to see these things before me. It was fascinating. It was great.
Wow. Man, makes me wish I went to college somewhere else.
Okay.
Now, let's get into your writing a little bit, because now we have a little background of what your inspirations are. What gets you pumped up to write? Do you listen to music? Do you go for a walk? Exactly. What do you do before you sit down and start typing?
You know, I think it's definitely music. I think I'm a big music fan. I draw a lot of information from genres, different lyrics, and I think music, just like writing, is a fabulous art form. I think certain levels of music can, not necessarily your top 40 and what have you, will really evoke so much emotion in a person if presented lyrically in the right way. And I try to do that with my writings as well. Like, that's kind of what I want. I can see that effect that that could have. And I music is definitely it for me.
Awesome.
I like a lot of metal, indie, a little of everything.
Okay.
Oh, he said metal. He's already won me over.
Yep.
Hey, the right car, you have to have metal.
Yeah, I was very happy that when I got my it was a very bad experience of having to get a new car, but the good thing that came out of it was that I got the Sirius XM Octane. So that fuels me through most of the day, that listening to Octane.
Nice. Now, considering the classes that you've had and the inspiration that you've drawn from, when you write a story, especially the two that you've contributed to the Southern Haunt series, are your stories metaphor for something deeper? And if so, may we ask what those are?
Definitely. I do think that I try to have some sort of symbolism deep in these stories that somebody could uncover if they really looked at the different cues and tried hard enough. The cleansing, we'll take a look at the first one first. The cleansing, in my degree in sociology, like, we do talk a lot about the different social institutions that are in the world today, and, you know, the correctional system and criminal justice system and things like that. And the New Mexico State Penitentiary and where the riots happened, it gave the perfect setting to really just have some sort of commentary on that kind of thing. So this, and even the first page in the cleansing, you know, it uses the word cleansing when it's describing this idea of society really discarding all of those deviants and cleansing itself of all of these people and confining them into this prison, which was then this huge epicenter of chaos and hardship, you know. There was also a lot of personal symbolism in the cleansing as well. I wanted people to sort of, readers specifically, to sort of not focus so much on horror being these things like blatant blood and gore and things like that, but I wanted them to sort of think that, you know, there's a variety of things that can be haunting to us. So in the cleansing, I specifically constructed these characters because I wanted the main character to be haunted emotionally by this memory and this feeling and this longing for this other person. And that's exactly the kind of personal symbolism that I drew from my own life and put into that story. It was important to express that somehow. It was almost a cleansing of myself, if you could say.
Awesome. Now, what about, And There Was Nothing Left But Ash, what about that one?
The new story did have a certain degree of it. I focused with both stories on sort of relationship dynamics, and the one was more about loss and longing, and the new story is a completely different kind of relationship. So it's nothing like you've seen in The Cleansing. It's just almost the polar opposite. This love story and this undying love, and they try to find one another, and they will stop at nothing. But who knows? Other than that, the thing about And There Was Nothing Left But Ash. The thing about that story is I really got psyched about the place that I started to investigate here in New Mexico. I've never been there before. I've never seen it now. I've been there, but I just got so intrigued by its background and its history here that I just dived right in, and I let it take me away. It was wonderful.
Yeah, when I was reading the stories, that's I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm glad he's clarified that, because I thought the title referred to, like, what happens to readers reading his fiery works. You know, they get, you know, nothing left but ash after reading one of Miguel's stories.
I would accept that.
And,
it's wonderful.
And, you know, here's what you touch on with your stories. You tap into the childhood horrors, such as the demons, the ghosts, but also at the same time you tap into the emotional horrors that adults face, which would be loneliness or something physical ending in your life that you are used to. And so you do a very good 50-50 shot of both sides of the horror there, so that's really awesome. Now, you had said that you recently were able to go to the location that inspired And There Was Nothing Left But Ash. Have you dabbled in paranormal investigation and research?
I do like to visit reported hauntings and haunted venues when I travel. I've yet to see any sort of entity, anything conclusive at this point, but there have been some specific times where I feel like I was pretty close. A couple of years ago, some friends and I went to Phoenix, Arizona. I think we went to see a Green Day and AFI at the Verizon Wireless Amphitheater or something like that. And we stayed at this place called the Hotel San Carlos, and it's downtown in Phoenix. It was built in the 20s. It's this fascinating older building, and the more I looked at that place, I chose it because it was specifically haunted, or so to speak. And the story is, you know, these star-crossed lovers, they have some turmoil, and the woman goes off to the roof and leaps to her death, and it was an interesting tale. So we go there, and I wanted to see what it was like, and once we get there, you know, we told them we were from out of town, and we requested to stay in the room where the couple had stayed, and they let us. It was a wonderful experience. And so as the night progressed, we ended up getting a noise complaint, and a maintenance man comes to the door and tells us, you know, to be quiet, and so he finishes up with us, and eventually a couple of minutes later he would come back, and he asked us if we wanted a tour of the entire place. And we really jumped at that opportunity. So he really took us into all of these different hidden areas of this hotel that most people don't go. You know, he had all the keys, and he probably shouldn't have done that realistically, but he did. He even took us up on the roof, and we saw the actual place where this girl jumped to her death. And that was fascinating, just to be in that environment and know that those things happened historically in the past. It was very interesting. And I did snap a picture on that roof, and but still to this day, it's very questionable. You know, a lot of people question the validity of orbs, and they think sometimes it might be just like a speck of dust or something. But there was something very strange about this orb that I caught, and it was just multicolored, and there were just vivid turquoise and greens and purples, and it just out of nowhere, it was shocking. And I still have it. I could show it to you all sometime. It was wonderful.
Oh, yes. Please post that on the Southern Haunts fan page. We would really love to see that.
Excellent. I will. To this day, you know, thinking back on that experience, I wonder if that man was even real, or if maybe we were accosted by some spirit in the hotel that said, let's give these folks a ride for their money.
Well, if you got his name, you could always call the hotel and ask for him, but, you know,
that's right.
They might tell you, no, we've never had that employee, sorry, and that would be your answer. Now, when it comes down to your free time, when you're not teaching or writing, what do you do to fill your free time?
I really like video games. Video games are really fun. They're something I take a lot of, it's taken me a lot of pleasure considering I don't really have a lot of free time, unfortunately, and still working on that master's degree. So if I'm not working, I'm doing homework and things like that. So every chance I get, I'll play some video games every now and then.
Awesome. Well, I do know that we have Southern Haunts 3 coming up, and we're hoping that you will be a part of it once again. And, of course, the deadline for that's May 1st, so, you know, hopefully we can get another Miguel winner here. Now, do you have any more writing plans in the future, such as can we expect any novellas or novels out of you? And if we can, like, what is your number one dream of writing a novel? Like, what would the subject be?
I think you can definitely expect something from me in the future. My goal is, you know, having this background in gender and horror and learning about these different theorists, and specifically Barbara Creed, this idea of the monstrous feminine and the things that are monstrous about femininity, things like the mother and border crossings and things like that. I want to write my own epic, monstrous, feminine story. So that's my overall goal in the future.
Oh, that's awesome. And awesome. Now for the age bracket.
Thank you.
No, like I really get into this stuff. So yeah, and you are very well versed on it. So I would love to read something by someone who actually knows what they're talking about. So yeah, that's exciting.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I could imagine the psyche that he gets into with it. It's, I mean, if it's anything near what he's produced for Southern Haunts, I mean, I can just imagine what he would do in a novel. I would be first in line.
Thank you.
Now, Is there any advice you can give regarding your steps that you take while writing a story, such as do you outline, do you write biographies for the character? Do you have an idea in mind already and you just go with that, or do you just let the pen work its magic for you?
I did find over the course of writing these two stories that I do have some sort of method, and it's definitely outlining. And I hope my students are listening right now, because outlining is very, very important. And I did that in my own stories. I when I came with the cleansing in the newer story, I just remember really sitting down and thinking about the events that I wanted to happen. And I would put those major events. I may start with the beginning, the middle, or I may even start with the end. And I just fill in those blanks around with the different ideas. So it really starts with this structural framework, and then it all comes together at the end. I even used colors with the last story, and there was nothing left but ash. I used different colors to signify just severity in the event, and a climax here, a climax there. It was, I'm very visual, so I need something in front of me that I can see and really look at this map of how this is going to pan out in the end.
Now, when I was reading, and there was nothing left but ash, even the artist who drew your photo to go with it, the story itself inspired the folk art, Latino, New Mexico art style. And I have to ask, are you a fan of the Mexican Latino film genre of horror, like the art house films that are produced?
Definitely.
What's some of your favorites here? Because we could I could definitely see where there was a lot of art house in your work.
Mm. I think those films are really great. There's one by a more recent one. I think the name escapes me at this point, but I do like that genre and that art and everything. Have you ever seen the Wreck series at all?
Oh God, yeah.
Yes.
God, yeah, those are awesome.
I really enjoy the Spanish films and those influences. And I think Wreck, that whole series to this point, 1 through 3, I look forward to the 4th. It was a great series. And nothing, Quarantine, I'm sorry, America, but it did not compare to the Wreck films. foreign films are really great. I love them all.
Yeah, I'm really starting to notice that if you want something that is original or just scare your pants off, a lot of times when it comes to movies now, you kind of have to go to the independent side of cinema or the foreign side of cinema to find something that's noteworthy. I know for the longest time, and this wasn't a Spanish-based film, but it was a foreign film, I had fallen into this funk where I could not find any horror movie that just grabbed me. And one of my friends said, well, you need to go get the movie Let the Right One In.
Norwegian, if I remember correctly. Or Swedish.
Norwegian.
I really hope that we can embrace that a great deal more with our writing. I really hope we can.
They sure tried to with that remake, but it just didn't happen for me.
It took the longest time the foreign originals better. Like, I feel like there's something really lost in translation when we try to take the same story and reinterpret it for America. It just doesn't quite work.
There's just something lackluster about it.
For the longest time I didn't watch Let the Right One In because the original version that they had out on DVD and Blu-ray, they dumbed down the subtitles. And everybody who had seen it in theaters complained, and I'd never seen a studio do this, but the studio reneged and said, okay, we're sorry, and they re-released it. So if you look for it, and I finally found it, but if you look for it, you need to look on the back and make sure it says English, and in parentheses it'll say theatrical.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And that's something that I kind of learned the hard way, because when I saw the version that was first released, that very awkward scene where you see Ellie naked from the waist down and you discover it just doesn't look right, you would not understand that unless you read the book.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Censorship. Yeah, for the longest time, it's like if I wanted a truly disturbing horror film, I had to go to Asian cinema.
Yes.
Yes, definitely.
Yes.
The movie Audition, it disturbs me to this day.
Oh.
It moves like a very beautiful drama, romance, and then the last 15 minutes of that film, you just do not want to go on a blind date for the rest of your life.
Well, I'm not going to give anything away, but I when I was sitting there watching, I'm watching it, you know, alone in a dark room, and the scene with the telephone ringing.
Oh.
And,
yeah.
And I have never jumped so high in my entire life. But that whole movie was just, I mean it not only frightened you because you could totally see it happening. It just took it to a whole other level of disturbing.
He did. And the thing is, it's actually based off a novel. I want to one day get my hands on that novel. Don't know when I will, but I will. Now, while we're on the subject of scenes, Miguel, what movies have made you jump out of your skin? Besides, you know, the Silver Bullet that you had seen when you were younger.
That's right. It takes a lot to scare me. I can remember being younger when The Grudge first came out, and I went and saw that in the theaters. And, that's nowhere near as frightening as Ju-on, the original, but The Grudge, for some reason, I do remember seeing that with two friends, and I do remember jumping in the theater and literally wanting to leave. I didn't think I could stand it, and looking back on it now, I think the movies are relatively ridiculous, but that was one.
Now, with reading, because I understand you do quite a bit of reading as well, you wrote a little bit for the website we had up, Fear Themes, and I had seen some of the books that you had reviewed. Was there ever a horror book that just got under your skin, where you felt like as you were reading this it was hitting too close to home, or perhaps it was just a little too unnerving? Have you ever read a book that's made you feel that way?
Definitely. And it was actually one of the books that was assigned for my gender and horror course. And I think that was one of the things that the instructor was trying to get us to look at. The Fledgling by Octavia Butler, I believe. And it's about this young vampire girl. It's very similar to Let the Right One In to a certain extent, but she is this vampire girl, and she is trapped in the body of this young girl. She may be like 8 or 9, and from the horror perspective, she's not this young girl. She is this 1,000-year-old vampire, you know. So in this book, she's found in the woods by this gentleman, and you know he saves her, and they have this strange love affair, which is, you know, by society standards, that is weird and crazy, and. But she wanted you to sort of see that character wasn't necessarily this little girl. She was this older vampire. And I think that was the point of this book. It was this idea of these social border crossings. Again, this thing that if you look at it from one perspective, it is this horrific, vile thing. But if you look at it from the narrative, it takes on this whole new life. But I do remember that being sort of struck in an awkward way. Like as I read the book, I just wanted to put it down because it was very vivid in its descriptions, and I thought, like, this is just wrong and this is crazy. But I think at the same time, that author evoked this emotion in me that made me question those things, and it made me really nauseous at times. So I think that was a huge success.
Yeah, I've had people tell me that if you want to read books that really just get under your skin, Fledgling is definitely on the top of that list. And I heard American Psycho was as well, which I haven't read that one yet. But the book that really got under my skin was Gerald's Game by Stephen King. And if you haven't read that, it really works on a scare factor. Mm-hmm. Where it's very tangible, it's very realistic, and I thank God that we have cell phones now. I really, truly do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, if you ever wanted to know why a cell phone was invented, just read that book.
Yeah. I'll have to read that
one. For me, the first Sonya Blue book, I think, it was, like, probably one of my first ventures into splatterpunk territory, so I was kind of blown away by that as it was. But the whole, like, how she was transformed into a vampire, plus, like, completely, like, shatters her old way of life and, like, reforms her into this schizophrenic kind of alternate personality vampire. It was so just, oh my gosh, visceral and like emotional. I've never had a book before since actually make me vomit, but that did it. It was really, yeah. And I always feel like I'm like, this book is so good, it made me puke. Like, it was just incredible.
And, you know, a lot of people have said that about Clive Barker's The Damnation Game.
I haven't read that one. See, I find Clive Barker very relaxing. I really like him. Like, I'll read him before bed and just drop off. Like, I love his stuff. It's very, like, soothing for me. Maybe this.
I think the difference with Clive is that he can do some very twisted, very disturbing, some of the most vile things that you've ever, you know, that would never even think of. But he writes it with such poetry.
Yes.
That he makes the vile seem beautiful. And it's which in itself is pretty disturbing, but
yeah. Well, it's even like his throwaway, so like some of the stuff, like, I mean, like in the actual like story, Rawhead Rex, like, I mean, some of the references, it's not even really detailed, but like when you actually, your brain catches up and you get what it's referring to, it's just kind of like, oh my God. But he's very eloquent.
I mean, Rawhead Rex and Midnight Meat Train are two of my favorite short stories ever, so.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah,
Agreed.
Yes.
I think it's one of the better film adaptations, too, Midnight Meat Train, as far as like an adaptation of a screenplay. Yeah.
Yeah, it truly was. And as far as the Hellbound Heart goes, that inspired, of course, Hellraiser. The book is very beautifully written. And
I love
that
book.
Not trying to toot my own horn for the Southern Haunts Volume 2, but with Miguel's story and There Was Nothing Left But Ash, I saw a lot of Clive Barker in that story, such as we were introduced to scenes that were visceral, but they were also very beautifully constructed. And I'm like, please, please, please submit to Southern Haunts Part 3.
Oh, I've got some ideas. You'll see me again.
Awesome.
Well, I'd like to get him up for our convention next fall. He'd be a great guest.
I would love to do that. That's kind of my next goal. I want to attend one of these conventions. I haven't done that yet.
They're awesome. They are awesome.
Well, you're invited if you want to come, so definitely.
Wow, thank you.
Now, let's get on the subject of different styles of horror. I know that you're a fan of the thought-provoking horror and the art house horror. Now, the term or the genre of has a very nasty reputation to it, but I've always felt that with the movies considered torture porn, such as the Saw movies or, you know, things in that genre, if you look past the blood and gore of it, a lot of those are actually nothing more than crime dramas or suspense dramas, in my opinion. What's your views on the whole torture porn genre that was really high during about 2000 through 2010?
Definitely. We discussed this in both of the classes that I took, actually. We had an entire unit on torture porn. And I don't think I was honestly aware of torture porn until I'd watched it, but never realized there was some coined term for it until I took those courses. And I do feel that there's just a little bit, again, there's a reason, this catalyst that the films were made and in the time frame that they were made. Let's take, for example, Hostel. Hostel came out around this time, you know, in American culture when we've got, you know, waterboarding has just been illuminated and there's this fear of this degree of torture. You know, we're just starting to invade other countries and we're just starting to do all these things that were very contentious. And so that sort of increased this level of Americanized fear. And Hostel and movies of the sort were sort of responses to that fear, this idea of going over to this other country and not knowing these people, but it just seeming like this really good idea, and then you get stuck into this twisted game of self-destruction. I think, again, with the horror genre, there are certain aspects that are just a little deeper, but you really have to uncover those things.
I do agree with that, and even one of the most infamous movies, I guess this is kind of trickling off of that genre as that genre is starting to die out, but Serbian film, it's one of those movies that people said, if you see it, you cannot unsee it, and I worked myself up to watching it. I watched it. I cannot say I agree with what I saw, but at the same time, I understand the political statement that the movie made.
Yeah,
it made it with a slap in the face.
Definitely.
But, you know, it's the elements that were in it.
I remember watching the Serbian film with my friend Erica, and we watched, and it was another one of those movies that, you know, once you got through it, it was nauseating. When you were done with a Serbian film, you wanted to puke. That was, you know, the ending, the culmination of that entire movie is just a huge, contentious mess. But, I mean, is that horror? It provoked that emotion in the viewer, and it made you feel that way. And, yes, it might have been this obscene thing, but I think that it was successful in its delivery of doing provoking those emotions in the viewer.
I agree. And it also, I think movies, not all of them, but some of them, and also books, this goes for books as well, depending on how extreme the subject matter, you also have to have a point for it that is equally as strong that says, well, here's what I just introduced to you, but I'm making you focus on the subject of this, and this that we see every day going on in our world.
And I think it was very successful in that aspect. It had that very controversial culmination, but at the same time, it was telling this story, you know, this social commentary and things like that. It was a little deeper, but again, it definitely pushed the envelope to a whole another level.
And, you know, it's the books and movies that have that extreme nature that do normally stand the test of time. And I'm not saying you have to be extreme to stand the test of time. You have pieces that are not horror-related, such as Gone with the Wind or To Kill a Mockingbird, so on and so forth, a lot of pieces in literature that have stood the test of time. But at the same time, those books or movies has focused on a subject that was just as equally strong as what we have seen in torture porn.
Yeah, they were time period pieces, and they epitomized these various, aspects and these various themes and things like that, and I think that's why their longevity has been so sustained. And I think the cinema is the same way.
Yeah, they become infamous. They become the Lolitas of our generation.
Definitely.
Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No problem. I was going to say, have you read J.F. Gonzalez's Survivor?
I have not.
That's another one that once you, in the written form, once you've seen, you can't unsee. That is a roller coaster of basically what it centers around is someone who is kidnapped and basically they're going to make a snuff film with her.
Oh.
And what she
that
does
reminds me of a Hard Candy. Have you ever seen that?
Right. Yes, yes. Hard Candy. Yes. Yes.
Have any of you guys and girls read Jack Ketchum?
Oh yes.
No.
Yes, I can't remember what the last one I read with him was. Yeah.
Yeah, that Survivor. That kind of sounds like a Ketchum style book. Now, who was the author of Survivor again?
J.F. Gonzalez.
Okay. I'm making a list here as I go along.
Yeah, I'm over here with my notepad.
Yeah,
I've
got my Word program open.
That is the first book, and I don't know how long that when it was over, I actually cried. I mean, it was
really.
Yeah, it was an emotional roller coaster for sure.
And, you know, as bad as this is to say, and maybe it's not bad depending on how you look at it, because sometimes if you're slapped in the face, it helps you mold your life in a sense of saying, okay, well, if I know of something like this going on, I'm more apt to report it versus, you know, just turning the other cheek and assuming, oh, well, you know, it's just someone's joking about this. They're not being serious about it because you see things every day in the news that are horrific events. And they happen to people that are your next-door neighbors that you just don't imagine them participating in something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I mean, look at the – oh, I'm going to get everything about this story wrong. But last year on the oh, I forget, Ariel, what's his face? I mean, the women who were pried out of that, you know, situation.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's awful stuff all the time. And unfortunately, we'd love to think stuff like that doesn't happen. I mean, all these stuff probably are extreme viewpoints of that. But, I mean, not too long ago in history, I mean, even there was stuff much more awful happening than what we would like to admit.
Is a comment on society and whoever said art had to be nice.
True.
No one.
Now, as we're drawing near the 10-minute mark here, just a little over it, is there any, like Facebook or Twitter pages that you would like to talk about and, you know, kind of describe what you might post on those?
I've got a Miguel Vizcarra Facebook that's my personal one, but I also have an author page. I normally post just a lot of different happenings, you know, the publications of the stories. When Fear Fiends was still up and running, I posted the different stories, different links to those stories and things like that. I try and keep followers up to date on my latest horror endeavors. For the most part, you can just search me on Facebook. The Southern Haunts page, I check that all the time as well. So there's ways to find me. On Twitter, I'm Miguel on a star, all one word, on a star. And you can find me. I'm around.
All right, he's getting a bunch of tags tonight from Jory. From Jory Loves the Story. She's loving the show tonight, and I see about 500 tags for Miguel. He'll probably get quite a few tags there.
Jory is the same.
Awesome.
I love Jory. Now, also, probably going to be the last question because I'm sure that you can elaborate greatly on this. Since you are big into the art, anyone who goes onto your Facebook page sees that you are just dressed with many tattoos. What is one of the tattoos you have that is most personal to you?
Oh. Let's see. Oh, that's a very good question. I didn't expect that. It's a curveball. Okay. Well, I've got a lot. Okay. Probably the most personal is on my left forearm, there's a heart, a black heart. And around that black heart are the initials of my mother and my two sisters, and also myself. I got that tattoo around the time where my father left and just completely abandoned all sense of responsibility. And it was this unifying thing, and it made me feel, it just made me feel great. I do love tattoos, and I do think that they take on this new life when you really have them on you and they mean something, and that one for me is very big.
Awesome. Now, are you still keeping count of your tattoos, or have you just said, I give up, it's just ink at this point?
I give up. I do give up. I saw a new one the other day on my fingers, which is my it's another one of my favorites. It says, "Will you join me in this dance of misery?" on three of my fingers. And it's an AFI lyric from the song Dancing Through Sunday, but it came out much better than I ever could have expected. It's wonderful.
Nice. Yeah, I know that you post about AFI quite a bit on your Facebook. It seems that you go to just about all their concerts.
In the last year, once they started touring again, I just started seeing them a lot. But my sisters, they like them. And, I mean, I've listened to punk rock and early AFI since I was very young. So it just transcends to a certain extent.
Nice.
And many of my tattoos are AFI related, honestly. I've got about four or five that are different song lyrics, different logos and things like that.
Cool. Yeah, I noticed that on your Facebook and sometimes on your Twitter, I can always kind of tell what mood you might be in because you post lyrics that are very relatable to life, and it's kind of one of those things where when I see it, I'm like, what's going on today?
And then that's cool. That's really, really cool that you say that because that's the reason I do it. I want them to be thought-provoking, and I want people to really see that, you know, lyrically, a lyric or a written, you know, sentence in this book, you can make it anything you want, and you can really stimulate so much thought with just those words that you put into it. And these words can be interpreted in a variety of different ways for a variety of different people. We may be experiencing two completely different hardships or two completely different things, but this word is still going to be the catalyst or the sentence that really makes you think about it, and it might move you to tears or something like that, but it will make you feel so many different things. And I want people to really look at it and be like, well, what does that mean to me? You know, how does that make me feel?
And once again, that's something that we see in your writing. I mean, it's something that we see with the cleansing, and there was nothing left but ash, because you do create characters that are very tangible to people that we see around us every day.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Now,
yeah,
as
really
we're drawing near...
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, I think that's really the key to horror, you know, across the board, is just having characters that people care about.
Yes.
You know, it was when we started the discussion about the slasher film as it arose in the 80s, and you know, where people were objectified as victims and whatnot, and you know, some of that is you know, after a while it became a, you know, not, you know, when the slasher film started, they were basically whodunits with gore.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then it kind of devolved into not who done it, but how's he going to do it?
Mm-hmm.
And
I think it all lies really in sympathy of those characters and who us as viewers, we look at these characters, and even in the books, even in the movies, where do our sympathies lie? And what is it about that character that makes us want to feel more for that character than this character? And, I mean, that was a big part of Hard Candy, which we talked about a few minutes ago. Hard Candy, from the get-go, is this tug and pull story of, like, do you believe this little girl? Do you believe this man? It's this huge mess. It's all about those sympathies and what makes us feel for one another and for other characters. I think that's what it boils down to.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, because if you give me a character that I care nothing about, that the name is just there to be a name to kill off, then why am I watching this? Why am I reading this? You know, it's you have to have some type of emotional connection.
Mm.
Now, as we are drawing near the last few minutes of this, was there anything you would care to add to tonight's interview? Is there anything you would like to shine the light on?
Hmm. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I think you pretty much well covered it with your wonderful questions.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I think we all have our notepads filled with new books and movies that we're going to check out at this point.
Yes.
That's great.
I was just mentioning Sayla, but I tell you what, you know, we've got to get Miguel back with Dr. Cooper,
yes.
L. Andrew Cooper from...
Yeah, oh
that, he, that would this would that would be his the killer encore show sometime later this spring, early summer.
We need Miguel from Imaginarium. We need them both on the horror panel. Like those two on the panel. Like
saying.
I would mediate the hell out of, or moderate the hell out of that. Like that would be dream come true. Like that would be awesome.
Oh. Yeah, we will do programming customized to you. It will be fun. Yeah, we will. And I think Miguel would love Dr. Cooper too. Because just hearing it just sounds So, but yeah, we're I guess we only got like about a minute left, so I guess we're about ready for the close of the show here, and then next week we got Jory from Jory Loves the Story is going to be coming on with that's going to be talking about Books on a Subway. And that's going to tell you all about the program with that. So that's going to be a pretty cool show, take a little bit of a different topic than we've covered yet.
And
I'm sure
Jory is listening, which I want to give her a little shout-out and say I really appreciate all the Twitter information that you have loaded me up with. It is helping.
Yes.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
I'm working on it, Jory. I swear I am. I've just been busy with edits this week, but I will get back to you because, she's awesome with that.
Well, I don't want time to cut out on this, but I do want to say thank you so much for coming on here tonight, Miguel, and I'm sure that we're all enlightened quite a bit more for those who were unfamiliar with certain genres, movies, or books, and it really brought an understanding to titles that might not have been noticed yet, so thank you for doing that.
Yeah,
thank you
for having
me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. It was very fun. I will do it again anytime you ask.
Yeah, Alex has told us so much about you. I've been dying to hear you live, so this has been great. This has been great.
Well, it was my pleasure to meet all of you. It was much fun.
Take care.
You too.
Night, everybody.
Good night, everyone.
Night, everybody.
Yep, night, everyone.